Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. It ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police departments. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 0.035% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? March has never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I will be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you are driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out. Took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. And there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and beg. Because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Malcolm Gladwell is here. He is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. His first two books, The Tipping Point and Blink, each sold well over 2 million copies in the United States. His unique take on the world ultimately has even spawned its own term, Gladwellian. His new book is called Outliers, The Story of Success. I am very pleased to have him back at this table. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Now tell me, I said to you as you sat down, I am fascinated by performance mm-hmm. And success in terms of the essence of it and how do you get there. Not that there's a magic formula, you know, but what can we understand about it?
Yeah. No, it is, it's this sort of perennially interesting question. And there are so many different answers depending on who you ask and when you ask them. And that's why we keep returning to it. If it was some little simple algorithm we could apply, it wouldn't capture our imagination in the same way.
It is said that part of the reason for this book, and there is some personal biography here,
mm-hmm.
you talk about your grandmother,
mm-hmm.
Was that you were in search of explaining your own success, this phenomenal success you've had.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was a conscious attempt. I would never do something so explicitly autobiographically, consciously. But I suppose on some level, I mean, that question began to occur to me because my own success doesn't seem to me to be entirely rational or it certainly wasn't anything I would have expected.
And you couldn't necessarily look at particular biographical points and say, aha, this guy is going to be either president or write bestsellers.
Yeah, it seemed that I got really lucky. I mean, luck is a huge theme in this book. And it's funny, and you know, we're not very good with luck. We tend to sort of discount it. We'd always rather give a kind of considered explanation for something than just to say it's happenstance. But you know what? A lot of the time, it really is. And I try and sort of zero in on what is exactly the nature of the lucky break that characterizes so much of truly outstanding success.
Okay, let's take an easy example that you use.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Gates.
Yeah, so Bill Gates is lucky in many ways.
Yeah, very bright.
Two ways in particular. One is that when he walks into eighth grade at Lakeside Academy in Seattle in 1968, there is a computer terminal sitting there with a link into a mainframe in downtown Seattle. No one had access to a computer terminal in eighth grade or ninth grade or 10th grade or even college in 1968.
Anywhere else in the world.
No, and he himself told me, he's like, if there were 50 people in my position in 1968, I'd be stunned. And he basically spends his entire teenage years programming, right? Because of this gift. And he would tell me one point, Paul Allen, his great high school buddy, with whom he co-founds Microsoft, discovers there's a mainframe down at University of Washington that's free, it's not being used, between 2 and 6 in the morning. So he goes to bed at 10 o'clock, sets the alarm clock, climbs out the window, whatever, at 1:30 in the morning, walks 2 miles to the University of Washington, and programs from 2 till 6. Now, I love that story because it's the two parts of his success are right there. One is the extraordinary desire and obsessiveness and determination and love of computing. But the other is the fact that he's a guy who lives 2 miles from a mainframe in 1973 that's free between 2 and 6 in the morning, right? Okay. Now, lots of people may have the first thing. Almost no one has the second thing, right? I could have walked for a month and not come on to a mainframe.
Right, but this is central to what you were saying here. And so let's explore it in more. The Beatles.
Yeah. Same thing. So Beatles, I mean, I'm really interested in one of the other themes I come back to in the book is this notion of how long does it take to be good at something?
Exactly.
And psychologists who have looked at this in the expertise literature have said, you know what, if you look at a whole range of cognitively complex activities, time and time again we see that expertise is reached only after a minimum of 10,000 hours of practice. And that roughly translates to 10 years of doing something. And I do this actually now with anyone who's good at something. I could do it with you right now. I just ask people, all right, in your career, what was the point that you started to feel comfortable in your role? And it's always 10 years. It's always 10 years. And I'm sure if we did the math with you right now, it would come out to...
No, you're right, you're right, you're right.
And so this magic number of 10,000 hours, what that says is the first in a cohort to reach 10,000 hours has a huge advantage.
Mm.
So Gates having that computer down the street or that computer in eighth grade gives him his 10,000 hours before anyone else who was that age. The Beatles, before they come to America, get invited to go to Hamburg. They're still teenagers, and they become a house band in a strip club, and they play 8-hour sets 7 days a week for months at a time. They get their 10,000 hours in before the British invasion, right? That's why they're good. I mean, that's not the only reason, but absent that kind of intensive grad school in rock and roll, they're not the band that we think they are, and they don't make that splash when they come to America.
And I assume that you could look at people who have been great athletes where there's a demand for poems at a young age,
yeah,
and discover that they started practicing under very good circumstances very early. Tiger Woods would be Exhibit 1.
Would be Exhibit 1. And the key, what you just said is key. What you said, under very good circumstances. This is not just Michael Jordan going out and shooting baskets. The term that expertise researchers use is deliberate practice. That is to say, focused, intensive practice with an eye to zeroing in on your failures and addressing them, your weaknesses. And I'm sure, you know, I would love to have a camera on Michael Jordan as a 16-year-old as he plays basketball and seeing, because I am convinced that that's what sets him apart, that when he practiced in a different way, and that he was constantly thinking about what am I not doing well and why am I not doing it well and what can I do to perfect it.
Because, you know, he didn't make his team as a 14-year-old or something.
Oh, yeah.
The junior
yeah.
high team didn't make it and then became a star and got a scholarship to University of North Carolina.
What's interesting, just to talk about Michael Jordan for a second, you know, unlike a lot of other basketball players, his game changes dramatically over the course of his professional career. And he's not a great outside shooter when he starts and has a, you know, devastating jump shot by the time he retires. So he never stopped this kind of constant process.
You know, he added to his arsenal once he became a pro, even. You know, there have been lots of examples of that. People that had a certain kind of college career, and then they found out once they got to be a pro that they needed to add to it. But what do we read into this? We read in this access to deliberate practice over 10,000 times.
Yes.
May give you the opportunity for success.
Yes.
The opportunity.
Yeah. Yes. And that's a big thing because, you know, ultimately this book ends up with a series of kind of policy prescriptions because it's supposed to be a way of thinking about this question of how do we help people achieve their potential, right? And there's all kinds of ways to do that. And the very simple answer from the book is you give them opportunities to work harder. And so I end the book, for example, with a chapter about the KIPP academies in this new breed of charter school, which is really based on this idea. There's nothing fancy about what they do. What they do is extend the school day, extend the school year into the summer, have school start at 7 and go until 6 at night, and have them come in on Saturday. And for kids who want to work harder, they will give you that opportunity. And the insight is that kids who want to work hard can't work hard unless there's a school there to do it.
That's true, too. But, I mean, what separates the kids who want to work hard from those that don't?
I have one of the chapters in the book is about Jewish lawyers.
Yes, right? Exactly. It's wonderful.
And it's all about this group of men who rise from the Bronx in Brooklyn, children of immigrants from Europe, grew up, parents in the garment industry, grew up in the tenements.
Right, in the 1930s.
In the 30s and 40s, and end up at the top of the legal profession in New York. This is hunger, right?
Right.
So, and one of the central ideas in that chapter is this notion that it was because they were discriminated against as Jews coming out of law school, and as a result, forbidden to work at the big downtown law firms, that they went out on their own and took up this unfashionable area of corporate law called takeovers, and practiced it in isolation and obscurity for 20 years, and then
all of a sudden it became a big deal.
Big deal, and they were at the top of the game.
And they were prepared. Preparation meets opportunity.
That slight, though, at the beginning, the big fancy WASPI law firm telling these kids named, you know, Greenberg or Flom or what have you, that you can't work here.
And we don't care what your grades were at Harvard.
And we don't care what you, or in their case, NYU.
Yeah, right.
But, well, yeah, we don't care. That, you know, that slight is of incalculable importance. I mean, you just said that Jordan doesn't make his team when he's 14, right? Again, that slight is that, I think that is the kind of added psychological.
But do you have that gene in you?
Did I have it? I don't think I've ever had a slight, but I'm not.
Not a slight. I mean, I don't think it has to be born of a slight.
No.
I think it can come from, and that's the intriguing question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just saw Rolling Stone. I mean, yeah, Rolling Stone has got a list of the 25 greatest singers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And including John Lennon.
Yeah.
Now, talent had something to do with this.
Yes.
Yeah.
So where do we put that?
You know, obviously it's there. What's fascinating to me is in the psychological literature on expertise, there are a whole group of psychologists for whom I have an infinite amount of respect, who will stand up and with a straight face say that talent doesn't exist, that it's all application and effort. Now, I don't know if I'm willing to go that far, but what that tells me is, look, we think it's this much, and it's not. It's this much. You know, it's some tiny fraction of what we think it is.
I believe that because I'm being fascinated by the subject of talent and performance and what makes people the way they are. I have, in the history of doing this, more than 30 years, years, this show, 18 years, I have never had somebody say to me, you know, the reason I'm so good at what I do is because I'm smarter than everybody else.
Yeah.
It is all because I wanted it more, I worked harder, I focused more, I sacrificed more, and, more importantly, I had a deep passion for the thing.
Yeah.
Whether it was swinging a golf ball, hitting a basketball, doing scientific research, being a diplomat.
Yeah.
And they never lose it. Yeah. And it is their best friend, their very best friend. Everything else takes, you know, and then you get into work balance and all that stuff. Am I right?
Yeah. No, you know, when I think about the story of the Beatles, what's fascinating about them, of course, is that they went to Hamburg in the 50s and were a house band in it, and were a house band for a strip club. Do we have any idea how miserable that must have been? 8 hour set. You must really, truly love rock and roll if you're willing to play as a house band in a Hamburgian strip club. I mean,
exactly,
it's like the nastiest situation.
Yeah. You're willing to take the sacrifices necessary to get there.
Yeah.
So what do we know about Barack Obama? I mean, here's a man who's had phenomenal success. He's at the epitome of power in the world.
Yeah. Well, there's two parts of Barack Obama that fascinate me. You know, the second half of my book is all about culture, but the role that culture plays in success, and how different cultures have very, very different strengths in different. And so I spent a lot of time contrasting Asian and Western cultures, for example, and talking about how Asians kids are better at mathematics for cultural reasons, that there's something about their culture that's beautifully suited to the
test. This is intriguing, though. I mean, it tells what it has to do with.
Well, I think it has to do. So we make this observation that there's a huge difference in the performance of Asian kids and Western kids on math tests, right? And we know it's not. We've refuted the genetic argument. They're not genetically better at it. And we also know that from a series of psychological tests that they work harder, and that's the key. They're just simply willing to persevere more. The application of effort is greater. So why? And I have this whole chapter, which is I think it has to do with patterns of agricultural practice going back hundreds, if not thousands.
Having to do with rice.
Rice. My father's European peasant ancestors, who were, you know, in the wheat fields of northern England, probably worked 1,000 hours a year and had lots of holidays and were drunk most of the winter and sleeping and worked till noon every day, right? Their Chinese counterparts in that same period were working 3,000 hours a year, weren't drinking out off the afternoons, and weren't sleeping through the winter. They were putting in a second crop of rice. Rice cultures are renowned for the fact that rice is infinitely more labor-intensive than traditional Western agriculture. And I think that if a culture engages in that kind of intensive work for 1,500 years, it doesn't go away. And so you take that child who is the product of that kind of culture.
It makes you good at math.
You sit that child down in front of a calculus problem, and they're going to approach it differently. And, you know, some people laugh when I give this theory, but here's the thing. No one has a better theory, right? We don't have any other explanation.
I know.
And the difference between Asian and Western performance is not this much. It's this much. It's enormous, right?
I mean, that's always a very good question and a good argument. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. What's the better idea?
Yeah.
And nobody says.
Yeah,
you know.
Someone's got to give you a better idea.
Okay.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project. So my guest today is Josh Kaufman, and this is a special episode. One of the things that we've discovered through a lot of our viewers is that the process of trying to live a good life, a better life, often requires you learning a new set of skills. We've had a ton of questions over the last year from people who say, I would love to do this, but I don't have time in my life to do it. I don't want to wait forever to make it happen. So we're bringing you Josh, who's also the author of a book called The First 20 Hours, who's an expert in, I guess, what I would call accelerated learning. So great to be hanging out with you today.
Thanks for having me. Great to hang out.
Couldn't sort of like have asked for a better person to drop in at a better time, because it really is. It's an interesting thing. It seems like the world is moving faster.
Mm-hmm.
We all want to get stuff done. A lot of people want to make big changes and feel like they're living better lives, but they look out there and they're like, there's stuff that I need to know, stuff I need to learn, stuff I need to master to do it. And I just don't have time in the day to
right.
do it.
Right.
So I'm curious. I mean, I want to get like right in with you, sort of like the idea behind your book.
Sure.
But one quick question first, which is, what was the motivation for you to actually go down this rabbit hole?
Yeah. So two primary motivations. The first is, you know, in terms of the research and the writing that I do, I like to look at topics that are like fundamental human experiences, like things that everybody needs to know or everybody deals with in some way, shape, or form. And those things can be, you know, big and complex and scary and frustrating in a lot of ways. But if you just dive in and break it down, what you often find is it's not really as hard as it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the motivation was, you know, learning is something, you know, learning new skills is a fundamental part of what it is to be human. Mm-hmm. And so let's figure out how to do that. Let's figure out how to do it better.
And most people, like, for most people, the thought of, I mean, for me, the thought of learning new stuff, I'm giddy. I love
yeah.
it. But for a lot of people,
it's terrifying.
Right.
Right. Particularly if it's something you know would be super fun or super valuable, but you know nothing about it, and you just look at
right.
it like, oh my gosh, this is really big. The motivation for me personally was, I run my own business. My wife, Kelsey, runs her own business. And 2.5 years ago, our daughter, Leela, came into the world. And all of a sudden, we had zero.
Right.
Zero free time. And so, you know, I, just like you, I really geek out about this stuff. I have a list of things that I want to learn a mile long. And so, you know, not having any time, it's like, okay, I may only be able to set aside, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes a day.
Yes.
So if that's all I have, then, you know, let's figure out how right. to learn as quickly as possible in that short time.
And at the same time, you don't want to wait forever to get,
exactly.
to get results. I mean, that's,
yeah.
a lot of people are like, okay, I could figure out, like, I could scrap somehow to find, like, that half an hour a day. But does doing it so little mean that it's going to take me, like, 10 years
yes.
to actually be decent enough at it so it'll actually be fun?
Right. And what I found through my research is that totally not the case. It doesn't take very long.
Yeah.
Even if you know absolutely nothing, or you only have a certain amount of time every day to sit down and learn it, you can become very, very good at something in a very short period of time.
Mm.
I think that's fun.
So, but this flies in the face to a certain extent also in what like has commonly become known as the 10,000 hour rule.
Sure. A little bit. It's actually a lot more complimentary than it would seem at the surface. So the whole idea of the 10,000 hour rule came from research by Kay Anders Erickson,
right.
Florida State University. And the idea behind that was, you know, if you look at the people in ultra-competitive, easily ranked fields, professional golfers, musicians, all of these folks where you can get an estimate of who really is the best in the world in an objective level.
Right.
The question that Dr. Erickson was researching is, what does it take to get to that level
right.
on
like
some
top,
very
top,
narrow
top
thing?
World.
Yeah. So yeah, if you want to step on a golf course and compete with Tiger Woods, that's about the amount of time it's going to take you to get there. But the vast majority of us, that's not the goal. That's not what we're trying to do.
Mm.
We just may have something in our minds that we want to accomplish, or an area of life we want to
yeah.
explore. And it takes a lot less time to get what we want out
right.
of something.
And I guess for a lot of people, the motivation is probably one of two things. You want to get good enough so you enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
And, or maybe like professionally, you want to develop a skill set enough so that you can actually start to leverage it to
absolutely.
Build your career or change your career for a lot of people.
Yeah. Like, so there are a bunch of things that you can learn that can help you, you know, do better in your business. There are a bunch of things that you can do to do for fun. It doesn't take that long.
Yeah. So let's dive right into it, because you kind of have a methodology
yes.
that you've developed. So take us through the, I guess it's five sort of like core ideas.
Yeah. Okay, so the first step in this process, and this is something that applies to every skill, could be a motor skill like, you know, learning how to fly an airplane or skateboard or something like that. Could be a cognitive skill like language or programming or something. So the first step is deciding exactly what it is you want, right? Why are you jazzed about this thing in the first place? If you're able to really clearly define what it is you're trying to get, it's called setting a target performance level. The more clearly that level of performance, or the more clearly you can define that, the easier it is for you to look out into the world and find ways to get there in the most direct way possible. Right?
So like, what's an example of that?
So for example, for me, I learned a lot of things in the process of putting together this book. And one of the things that I wanted to be able to do was program. And so instead of just saying, I want to be a programmer, right? Doesn't give you any information whatsoever.
So amorphous.
It's here is this idea of a program that I would like to sit down and create from nothing. And it looks like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. When I make this thing, I'll have developed the skills that are necessary in order to get the particular result, right?
Got it.
So instead of learning everything in the world about programming, I decided this is the subsegment of that skill I'm interested in learning first, so that's what I'm going to focus on first.
So it has to be like very goal-oriented and also very specific.
Yes. So what is it going to look like when you're done? What are you going to be able to see or experience that'll let you know you reached the level that
you want? Okay, so like if you want to learn a language, is I want to speak French enough, or is it...
Not enough.
So like,
yeah.
What would that look like in your sort of like framework?
So let's say, for example, I want to go to a restaurant that has a French-speaking waiter, and I want to order and conduct the entire meal in this language and have a good time doing it. That's something that's specific enough to practice.
Got it. Okay.
So you almost make it too specific at the beginning, because once you get to that level, you can always ratchet up the stakes, right? You reach that threshold, practice something else.
I mean, what I found is once you get just like the most baseline proficiency in something, it sucks less.
Yes.
And now you actually, like that baseline level, it creates a whole new level of motivation to want to learn more, because now you've kind of gotten through like the scales in music or something like that.
Yeah, and it's important to understand that the first couple of hours of practicing something new are frustrating.
Yeah.
For everyone. Everybody's terrible at the beginning. And so, you know, if you can push through those early few hours, the practice itself becomes fun and it becomes way easier to continue to improve.
So, okay, so that's number one.
Yep.
Number two.
Okay, so after you decide what you want, you do what's called deconstructing the skill. And the idea behind that is a lot of the things that we think of as skills, like, for example, playing golf or speaking French or learning how to program, those aren't exactly skills. They're really kind of general topics that contain lots of smaller sub-skills.
Right.
So it's really hard to practice being a good golfer. It's way easier to practice hitting off of the tee with a driver. Right. So you take the global skill and you break it up into much smaller parts. And if you're clear about what you want, it becomes very easy to find what are those sub-skills, what are the smaller parts that are actually going to help you get to that target performance level as quickly as possible.
So like if there are 100 sub-skills, if you've done number one, it makes it much easier to figure out, okay, what are the 15 of those sub-skills that are going to give me 80% of the results towards getting where I want to go.
And what you often find is it's only maybe two or three sub-skills that you use most of the time.
Huh.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, breaking it down into small enough chunks. If you do just a little bit of research, which is actually step three, right? You go out into the world and you find sources of information that help you do this deconstruction. If you look at, you know, say for example, pick up 5 books on whatever it is that you're trying to learn how to do. Don't read them cover to cover. Skim all of them, one right after the other.
Right.
And what you'll see is the two or three sub-skills that you're going to use most of the time are the ones that come up over and over again. Right? So you just practice those first. And if you spend your time practicing those things and avoid a lot of the distractions or things that aren't going to help you, you save a lot of time and energy as you're practicing.
So that's a big question, so I'll ask you now. If out of a whole basket of potential sub-skills that add up to this thing that you want to accomplish, only a small handful are very often really, really critical, why are we taught to do them all at once?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that, actually. I think the biggest thing is we treat in our culture now learning as a very academic exercise. Like the objective is to suck in a ton of information about this thing, whether or not you're going to use it. And I think, you know, education in our culture now has been seen in the academic sense and less in the sense of practicing something with the eye of using it to do some particular cool thing.
So it's less applied.
Yeah.
More
So, you know, the whole idea of researching the topic and something that I had to train myself out of is I love doing research, right? So the first thing, like programming was a good example of this for me. It's like, I want to learn how to program. I get 10 books, I have these courses, I'm going to go through all of this stuff, and then I'm going to sit down and write a program. It's like, no. You use the research, do just enough research to help you do the deconstruction and find the most important sub-skills first, and then get out of research mode and into practice mode as quickly as you can.
Because that's where the real stuff's going to happen.
Yeah. And when you start practicing what it is you're actually trying to do, that's when you see the performance improvement.
Now, you also made a differentiation when we started the conversation between cognitive skills, like learning a language, and did you use motor skills?
Yep.
Motor skills, you know, like swinging a bat or, you know, playing golf. Do all of these steps, I mean, we still have two more to work through, but you know, with the three that we covered so far, are they all sort of equally relevant to both types of learning?
Yeah, so for both types of learning, you have to go through the same general process. Some of the actual practice techniques can be different. So for example, one of the things that you can do when you're practicing a motor skill, which works really well, is practice it within a couple hours of going to sleep. Either taking a nap or going to bed for the night. And there's a lot of research around the idea of what's called consolidation. So your brain translates the practice and experience you had and encodes neural connections to help you do it better.
Right.
That practice or that process is way more efficient if you practice within about 4 hours of going to sleep. So I, in the process of writing the first 20 hours, I retaught myself how to touch type on a different keyboard, which was like, you know, having the experience of rewiring my brain to do something differently.
Right.
And then, you know, fun things like playing the ukulele, which is all motor skills. And it's surreal experience. I would practice it right before I would go to bed. And, you know, the first couple hours of practice was just terrible.
Right.
So I would practice, I'd go to bed, I'd pick it up first thing in the morning just to see. And it was like astounding how much better I was after a couple hours sleep.
That's amazing.
Because, you know, sleep helps consolidate that kind of
stuff. Yeah, that's really cool.
So yeah, some of the actual practice techniques are different, but the same, the general process is the same.
Right. So that's pretty remarkable. You literally wake up in the morning and you're better than you were when you went to sleep just because you slept in the middle of it.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so for
like, noticeably better? Like, really?
Noticeably better. Like, you know, one of the, in the process of learning typing, like, you know, once I switched keyboard formats, I went from typing about as fast as I could think to literally, like, 5 words per minute. Like, terrible.
Right.
And so, you know, practicing right before bed and getting up in the morning and trying to use my computer, like, in the first couple of days I was doing it, it was like, oh my gosh, I can actually type now. I can do something.
That's crazy.
And yeah. So you know, that type of thing works for a motor skill. For cognitive skills, memorization techniques like spaced repetition reinforcement, like flashcard model or flashcards with feedback helping you remember things works really well. So yeah, the actual practice techniques can be very different, but the core method of learning is very much the same.
And again, for both of them, before you go to bed.
Yes.
Helps with the consolidation.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. What about simulated practice?
Simulated practice can be effective as long as it is as close to real-world performance as you can make it.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of the, you know, trying to memorize something and then having that translate directly into practice doesn't really work.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more in terms of, like motor skills.
Okay.
Yeah, like when I was a gymnast when I was a kid, we would, you know, before any event, you know, I would basically, before I would step up to a piece of apparatus, I would kind of close my eyes and I would actually envision my body, like, moving through the entire thing.
Okay.
And then there was all this research that said that, you know, it triggers all the same motor neurons that would be triggered, like, the same response in your brain.
Yes.
as if you were actually doing it. But I'm curious in terms of sort of like, you know, accelerated learning, whether that would actually make you progress faster and towards a high level of proficiency in that skill.
Yeah, there is quite a bit of research that says that imaginary types of practice does work, and it works well, with a catch, which is you have to do it in addition to
the real
physical practice.
Right.
Right. So if you're starting to consolidate those motor movements and you're doing that in practice, and then you're reinforcing that with imagined practice, awesome.
Got it.
But you know what I found is a lot of people get caught up in the process of just doing the physical practice
right
first.
So we got to three of the five steps now. Mm-hmm. So let's kind of like close the loop here. So step number four.
Okay. Step number four is removing barriers to practice. So things that are preventing you from actually sitting down and doing the work.
Okay.
Sometimes those things are environmental distractions, like, you know, turning off the TV or blocking the internet or closing the door. You know, all of the things that you can do to make sure in those early hours of practice, which are frustrating, you don't get so frustrated that it's easy to stop focusing on whatever it is that you're doing and start paying attention to something else. You know, likewise, anything that you can do to make sure it takes as little energy as possible to start practicing is super helpful at that point. So, you know, instead of keeping your guitar in the case in the back of the closet on the other side of your house,
right?
Take the guitar out of the case, get a stand, put it right next to your next to your couch. And that just, you know, anything that you can do to make it easier on yourself to get those early hours of practice, the better.
Yeah, I mean, my guitar is actually hanging out on a rack because of that. It's like almost because I just forget it's even there.
Totally.
You know, it's like the visual cue actually makes a really big difference for me. Yeah. All right, so number four is, now, I'm curious also, I mean, it sounds like there's a bit of crossover between that and sort of like B.J. Fogg's work on really
tiny habits.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, a lot of the same, you know, this is where the behavioral psychology elements of this come in.
Right.
It's how can you make it easier to do the thing that you want to be doing instead of getting distracted by some shiny object and going and doing something else. So instead of relying on exerting a lot of willpower to force yourself to do this thing that you've decided you want to do, you spend a little bit of willpower, a little bit of time and energy altering the structure of the environment around you.
Right.
And just make it easy as possible to do the thing that you want to do.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, last item, number
last
five.
Last one. Pre-commit to practicing at least 20 hours. And this is the big one. So all the things that we've talked about so far is getting set up to sit down and do the work of actually practicing. The pre-commitment and the idea of practicing at least 20 hours, there's a lot of behavioral psychology behind that. The two big things is, first, it's a really important check on your reasons for learning this thing in the first place.
So it's kind of like, if I'm not willing to commit to 20 hours, I can't be all that serious about it.
Yeah, it's like, is it worthwhile for me to rearrange my schedule and stop doing other things? And, you know, is this something that I'm expecting to get enough benefit from to make the effort worth it?
Yeah.
If it's not, don't do it.
Right.
Life is short, you know? It's like, go do something else that you will get more benefit out of or you are more excited about. So if you're willing to set aside at least 20 hours, what the pre-commitment does is make sure that you practice long enough to push through that early frustration and actually start seeing results. And I think a lot of us really seriously overestimate just how long it takes to become good at something. Mm. So you can become really, really good at something, surprisingly good at something, in as little as 20 hours.
Mm.
So if you practice that long, you're going to be way better at the end of that than you were at the beginning.
Yeah. I guess a lot of people also figure, well, you know, 20 hours, you know, I've done that with a million different things and, you know, I really wasn't very good. But probably when they actually look back and say, well, no, like I missed 3 days here and like that one day where I, you know, said I was practicing for an hour, I was really only practicing for 10 minutes. So when you really add up all the time, I'm guessing there's a little bit of self-delusion that happens.
There's actually quite a bit of research behind this. Our minds are not built to accurately estimate time. And in the early parts of learning something new, it's like, you know, it's terrible. It's like, oh man, I've been at this hours. And you look at the clock and you've been at it 10 minutes.
Right.
And so a lot of the, you know, both pre-committing to a certain amount of practicing. So 20 hours roughly is about 40 minutes a day for a month, give or take.
So you kind of think in your mind, 40 minutes a day for a month.
So a couple of, and I usually break my practice sessions into about 20 minutes apiece, right? So two 20-minute practice sessions every day for about a month can get you there. And so, you know, if you're able and willing to do that, pre-committing the time, make sure that you practice long enough to see that really good result. But it's also, you know, psychologically not, it doesn't feel like that big of a hurdle to say, okay, this is important to me.
Right.
I can set aside at least that amount of time, right? So it's just enough that you're going to see dramatic results, but not so much that it prevents you from making the pre-commitment in
right.
the first place.
I love that. So let's recap the five steps.
Okay. So the five steps in order. Step one, decide what you want. What's your target performance level? Mm. Step two is deconstruct the skill. Separate it into smaller subskills. Practice the most important ones first. Number three is research the skill just enough to do the deconstruction and choose the most important subskills, but not so much that it becomes a barrier to practice mm-hmm. in itself. Number four is eliminate barriers to practice. Make it easy to do what you want to do. And number five is pre-commit to practicing whatever it is that you want to be able to do for at least 20 hours.
Mm. Love it. All right. So my mind is spinning because I'm thinking to myself, okay, what am I going to do?
I was going to ask, what's in the back of your mind? Have you always wanted to learn how to do?
It's interesting. I mean, languages. Because I don't speak another language. Mm-hmm. I took Latin for 6 years, which means I speak nothing but English. It's interesting. Like, I want to blurt out a whole bunch of different things, but number five is making me say, I need to really think about this.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to, like, say, okay, people, I'm going to commit to this publicly.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, an hour after we film this, I'm like, I'm not really, like, willing to put in my 20 hours for that. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. I'm really thinking that through. Awesome conversation, and I love sort of like the breakdown that you have. And this is all, I mean, obviously detailed and, you know, a whole bunch more extensively in the first 20 hours. But thanks for stopping by and sharing this with me, because like I said, one of the consistent questions that we keep getting from people is, you know, I know that for me to get to a place where I feel like, you know, like I'm living well in the world, I'm doing these things, career, personal, whatever it is, there's a body of knowledge that I need to know and get decent at. But I don't know how to do it, and I think it's going to take forever. So I think this is a really great formula to help people get there.
Thanks. And, you know, I think the really good news is that the outcome of this research is the barrier to sitting down and learning something new is not intellectual.
Mm.
We're all smart enough to sit down and figure it out and practice in a
right.
smart way. The barrier is emotional. And so, you know, a lot of these things are just working with ourselves in a smart way to decide we're interested in doing something, figure out how to do it, and actually sit down and
that.
Practice so we can do a bunch of cool stuff.
Love it.
That's fun.
Awesome.
All right.
Fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My guest today has been Josh Kaufman, the author of The First 20 Hours. I'm Jonathan Fields, signing off for Good Life Project.
that bread.
Man, you know you better take it on the lamb.
You better watch the man. I don't like the hood. What you say, Fred?
I said we better take it on the lamb out of here.
We better watch the man.
But
come over here, brother. Let me tell you something. You think we're talking too loud?
First that's first.
I ain't got no dust.
I don't have to take it on the lamb.
Watch that man.
Huh?
Watch that man.
Watch them. Yeah, all right. You're right. Yeah, yeah. Coming from some funny places.
What you say, bro?
What's happening, Brown?
Trying to get down. Well, you know, look at him. We can't have that.
That's right. Right on. Yeah.
Ain't no alcohol. Man, I don't dig it. What you say, Jason?
Hey, don't be so mean.
You know I'm clean now.
And on the seat.
Interest rates at an all time high.
Yeah.
But you still find the pot.
Okay, I pressed the wrong button. All right. We had to adjust here because of tech problems. And I got to get a new modem, it looks like. But in any event, today's podcast is titled The First 20 Hours House Building. Now, actually, we got two memes, but I only put one in it. We have two ongoing classes that we're starting. The First 20 Hours House Building, or Tiny House Building, and The First 20 Hours Gardening, not farming, but the first 20 hours gardening. Now, that will include, we have four packets of seeds donated to us earlier this year. So okra, tomatoes, honeydew melon. Let me see, what was the fourth one? Honeydew melon, okra. Anyway, we got four. All right. So we're going to take so it'll be the first 20 hours to growing food. All right, so we're going to really break it down, and I'll have a green thumb, somebody who's experienced with that, teaching somebody like me who knows nothing, okay, on how to grow. So these will be like little micro classes, we're documenting that stuff so you can see it on YouTube and the video on our Facebook page, and we'll do some things on here as well. Now, and then we'll have long sessions where, you know, we'll have video as well as audio live stream on Clubhouse, Facebook in particular, maybe YouTube. But if you don't have the Clubhouse app, download it to your phone, or I can invite you on. Because that's a very interesting, in my opinion, audio apps are going to take a further bite out of rated traditional AM and FM commercial radio, including XM. It's tiny right now. It's in the mustard seed form, but it's growing. I'm on three audio apps, but Clubhouse is the king of the hill for the time being, all right? But you know how that can go online. At one time, MySpace was out there, you know, and Google had something. I don't know why they stopped because it was going – I liked it. But anyway, well, Google's still a great – good search engine, but anyway, part of the global language, I'll Google it, but – in any event, so Clubhouse, if you don't have it, and need to get on, I can get you on it. But anyway, the first 20 hours. Now, we'll be going from the book and the lecture. There's a bunch of free lectures on YouTube titled The First 20 Hours, where the author of the book breaks it down. And then you can go to Kindle or Amazon Kindle and download one or two chapters for free. But I highly recommend, if you like the first chapter or two of the free version I download, it's worth getting the book. But we'll be going from that book, but we're adjusting it for what we do. All right. The first 20 hours of house building. All right. And the first 20 hours of gardening, using the seeds that we pack of seeds that we have already. Now, the reason, now, let me put this out there. More than likely, now here's the whole idea of the first 20 hours. You're not going, and let me throw out Malcolm Gladwell, because I played some of him early on. Malcolm Gladwell talks about, in his book, Outliers, he talks about to be world-class, you have to put in 10,000 quality hours at your craft. You know, the Beatles, as he gives as an example in the book, the Beatles put in their 10,000 hours of quality work ethic before we even heard about them on the Ed Sullivan Show or even heard one of their records in the United States. All right. Michael Jordan, he got cut from his 10th grade basketball team in high school. He put in his 10,000 hours, okay? So there are a lot of examples like that in the book and then all through life. So the first 20 hours deals with learning the fundamentals, learning the fundamentals of a particular craft or something that you want to learn. It could be a foreign language. In our case, gardening and house building. All right. Now, before you built the Taj Mahal or Buckingham Palace, you got to learn the fundamentals and start with something small. So that's what we're doing with the housing thing. But you have to learn the fundamentals. Now, it deals with the first 20 hours, you're learning the fundamentals, and you get enough practice time in where you, by the 20th hour, the end of the 20th hour, you know enough on an individual basis where you can self-correct. Learn from mistakes and then keep on going. All right, until you get the desired result that you want. All right, so you're not going to be a master carpenter. You're not going to be a master home builder at the end of the 20 hours. You're not going to be ready to farm a 40-acre plot of land at the end of the first 20 hours. But, you know, like with the, and that's why there's a distinction. Gardening and farming are two different animals. And our Green Thumb person that we'll have on, he'll explain that. All right. So before we can even think about tackling farming, we need to tackle gardening. Okay. So we're going to, in the first 20 hours of gardening, we're going to, and you know what? We got four packets of seeds. What are the growth cycles for each one of those? So we're going to take one at a time. So with the four packets of seeds we got, I can tell you right now, that's 80 hours, the first 80 hours. Because we're not going to get them all at one time now. You know, just like we had when we had to learn how to walk. You know, all of us came on this, when we came over our mother's womb, none of us knew how to walk. We had to learn that by trial and error. Okay. So, you know, we didn't learn how to walk, swim, jump rope, and all that stuff. No. We tackled one thing at a time. Well, you know, but, you know, eat, finger food, stuff, you know, that type of stuff. Okay. So with the gardening part, the first 20 hours of gardening is really going to be 80 hours because we're going to, you know, the first 20 hours of growing okra. Then from that, the first 20 hours of growing honeydew melon. That's 40 hours. And we're going to take, and then we can compare notes. Well, what did we learn from growing okra that we can look after we do the 20 hours on the honeydew melon? Let's compare notes. So that's going to be 80 hours right there. All gardening, not farming, but the gardening is the down payment on the farming. Farming involves, you can garden for self-consumption for yourself or your family and some neighbors or what have you, some friends. But farming involves, because with this garden, with gardening alone, you're going to produce enough. Well, you're not going to eat all of that. And that's just on the gardening part. So when it comes to, what do we do with stuff we don't? Stuff we don't give away. Are we going to catch it? That's why we're starting off with the first 20 hours of gardening. And then, and you know what? That's going to take us to the end of the year real easy. And then sometime next year, after we have gotten where we can self-correct and know what we're doing with our gardening, then we can step it up and look at, the first 20 hours of farming. But for this year, the two ongoing classes, the first, all documented, and you guys can participate with it, the first 20 hours of gardening, the first 20 hours of house building. I'm also arranging, we're going to be at an event in Chicago. Well, we'll be participating. That's a better word. We'll be participating at an event in Chicago at the end of this month. So I'll, what's her name? Mama Evelyn Johnson, her event. It'll be her 10th year. So I decided, instead of waiting a year, let me rein it in and see what we can do for this year. All right. And I'll tell you how that's all involved after I discuss it with her. All right, today's Wednesday. We're cutting it short today because of these tech problems, but we'll be on full tomorrow. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.